go.
All right then, Friday, 5 p.m. I think I am ready, Heidi. Time for American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 in Garden City. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my co-host and lovely wife, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well. Also, pretty darn good-looking engineer, so I have that on my side.
I'm a snazzy dresser.
On Fridays, we changed the theme of our show a little bit from our Wednesday setup. We call the show How Music Changed on Fridays, where we pick specific topics and or acts. We have a list of 250 of these that we consider to be among the most important of all time. We're running through them one at a time and taking as long as we want to on each topic to cover it as best as we can, depending on how much there is to actually get into. This is a rather obscure series that we've been doing here. We've been calling it From Memphis to Muscle Shoals, where we are looking at all of the boutique studios from that general area in the South and some of the great stuff that came out of there and some of the history that had happened. And we are both, Heidi and I have both been sort of like amazed and dumbfounded by how great some of this stuff was. I mean, this has just been a really fun series for us from beginning to end. We are getting near the end, though, now, speaking of the end. And in fact, this is show number 30 in this series. We've been doing this for over half a year, which is pretty incredible.
It feels like it's just gone by so easily, though, because of how much joy it has brought me.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. That's the glasses half full way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, as you get older, time goes by a lot faster. But it has been fun and very informative. But as we're wrapping it up, this is where some of the studios begin. We're telling the stories of the studios as things change, as they shift, as they lose their relevance, or as they break up. We, for example, just last week, we more or less covered the demise of American studios, which was very sad because they were really the crux of this series, them and Fame studios. So that's what we're going to do with this show today. We're going to move back to Fame and cover where we left off there. Now, if you do, just to have you catch up, Rick Hall is the man who founded Fame, and our very first show was about the early life of Rick Hall and how, because he really is the person that more or less put Muscle Shoals on the map. That he deserves credit for that, there's no doubt. And the musicians that were coming in and out of Fame were also often actually driving to American studios and working there. Dan Penn was Rick Hall's right-hand man. He ended up working at American for quite a while. So there's the tie-in that was happening there. Now, Rick Hall, of course, eventually by the 60s, had a group of musicians, eventually came to be known as the Swampers, who were just kicking out these great R&B-based hits, one after another, to the point where the greatest R&B acts of the time were coming to Muscle Shoals to work with Rick Hall and these musicians. But the problem was, eventually, the musicians began to get wise to the fact that maybe they could start their own studio, which they did. They actually formed something which they called the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio, which did not make Rick Hall very happy. And Rick Hall ended up losing some clients, obviously lost the musicians that he had. And this, of course, had him fired up. This was a guy who was going to compete no matter what it took. And he was not going to let this beat him the way he didn't let almost anything else beat him. So he did bring in new musicians, kept the ball rolling, and started to attract some new artists. I think when we left off, one of the last people that we had discussed that he was working with was Candy Staton. But you're going to see how things change here, because this is where Rick Hall begins to figure that he is going to survive and become successful at any cost. And what you will see is how the label and the crux, the direction of the label, starts to change because of that. Rick Hall will become incredibly wealthy, more wealthy than he ever was in his artistic peak in the 60s. It's a question, though, of where you stand with how he basically continues
along
his path to success. Right.
Right.
So I'm going to read a few things during the show to keep things moving. It's Rick Cole did write an autobiography called The Man from Muscle Shoals. And these excerpts will be taken from that book. I was driving down Avalon Avenue in front of my studio one day when I heard Bobby Gentry's Ode to Billy Joe on the radio for the first time. She was singing and playing her little gut string guitar and telling the dark and mysterious story of her life, which was very close to my life, with those Mississippi Delta strings playing back porch blues guitar riffs like I had never heard before. The violas, cellos, and violins sounded like they came straight out of the muddy waters of the Mississippi River. The world she sang about had been such an integral part of my upbringing that I felt like I had known this woman in another time or another life. I had never heard songwriting that was so raw, naked, and outrageously beautiful. I was so blown away that I almost ran my car head-on into another car.
Wow.
I felt I had a shot at producing some sides on Bobby since she was on Capitol Records, and I had some inroads there, especially since my good friend Carl Engelman was head of A&R there and would be influential in deciding who would produce Bobby's next record. A few days later, Carl, Bobby, and I had dinner at the famous Brown Derby restaurant in Los Angeles. Turns out Bobby was not just a little farm girl from Greenwood, Mississippi. She had graduated from UCLA with a degree in music and was also a professional painter who had sold some of her paintings for thousands of dollars each. She also owned a beautiful mansion in Beverly Hills and was coming off of a worldwide hit, Ode to Billy Joe. At the Brown Derby, Bobby showed up in an eye-popping Southern Bells ensemble that put cricks in the necks of every man in the place. She wore an extremely short red mini dress with large white polka dots and a wide-brimmed antebellum hat to match. She also had on red high-heeled shoes and a matching umbrella. She was a very outgoing and confident woman who knew what she wanted and how to get it. At the restaurant, I found that she had actually lived the song she wrote, with all of the poverty, pain, and shame that I had endured growing up in the Freedom Hills myself. We had lived similar lives in the same part of the Deep South and were immediately on the same page. I had been there myself and she knew it. We became musical buddies and wanted the same thing, a big old hit record. Bobby was coming off one of the biggest records of the day and, in fact, one of the biggest records of the past two decades. And I knew that Ode to Billy Joe was going to be a tough act for me to follow. I also learned that Bobby was dating her current producer, who had produced Ode to Billy Joe. I told her I wanted to produce her, and she said, "Well, good, Rick, what do I need to do?" And I said, "Write us another Ode to Billy Joe, one that's really you. We need another song like that, and it's going to have to come from your pen. Have you got another one of those songs in you?" And Bobby said, "I don't know, Rick, but I'll try." Well, sure enough, she called me back in a couple of weeks, brimming with enthusiasm and excitement. She said, "Rick, I think I've found a hit song for us, entitled Fancy." Here's that song.
I remember it all very well. Looking back, it was the summer I turned 18. We lived in a one-room, run-down shack on the outskirts of New Orleans. We didn't have money for food or rent, to say the least, we were hard-pressed. Then Mama spent every last penny we had to buy me a dancing dress. Mama washed and combed and curled my hair, and she painted my eyes and lips. And then I stepped into my satin dancing dress. It was split on the side, cleaned up to my hips. Well, it was red velvet trim and it fit me good. And staring back from the looking glass was a woman where a half-grown kid had stood. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. Lord, forgive me for what I do, please. But if you want out, well, it's up to you. Now don't let me down, your mom's gonna help you move uptown.
Don't let me down, don't let me down.
Mama, dad, a little bit of perfume on my neck, and she kissed my cheek. And I saw the tears well up in her troubled eyes when she started to speak. She looked at a pitiful shack and then she looked at me and took a ragged breath. Your paw's run off and I'm real sick and the baby's gonna starve to death. She handed me a heart-shaped locket that said, "To thine own self be true." And I shivered as I watched a roach crawl across the toe of my high-heel shoe. It sounded like somebody else that was talking, asking, "Mama, what do I do?" And just be nice to the gentleman fancy, and they'll be nice to you. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. But if you want out, well, it's up to you. Now get on now, girl, you better start moving uptown. Well, that was the last time I saw my ma. Then I left that rickety shack, cause the welfare people came and took the baby. Ma died and I ain't been back. But the wheels of fate had started to turn, and for me there was no way out. And it wasn't very long till I knew exactly what my mom had been talking about. Did what I had to do, but I made myself a solemn vow that I was gonna be a lady someday, though I didn't know when or how. I couldn't see spending the rest of my life with my head hung down in shame. I might have been born just plain white trash, but fancy was my name. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. Long after a benevolent man took me in off the street, and 1 week later I was pouring his tea in a five-room hotel suite.
Yes, you were.
Well, I charmed a king, a congressman, and an occasional aristocrat, and I got me a Georgia mansion in an elegant New York townhouse flat, and I ain't done bad. Hypocrites that would call me bad and criticize my mama for turning me out, no matter how little we had. And though I ain't had to worry about nothing for now 15 years, I can still hear the desperation in my poor mama's voice ringing in my ear. Here's your one chance, fancy, don't let me down. Uptown, and I guess she did.
There you have it. Rick Hall producing, obviously, Bobby Gentry with a song called Fancy. A very wordy song, an awful lot going on there. And he even said that he even had to edit it down. He thought that the song was going to be like 15 minutes long because she had so many words. He had to like help her edit them. And the song is also very suggestive of Ode to Billy Joe. The thing that's happening here, I think, is that now that Rick Hall is like working more or less independently without the musicians that he had and their input, is that you can almost see the strain in him trying to get the hit. Going as, you know, trying really hard. But as you said, he knew that the finished Fancy was without a doubt a big hit record. But even if it hadn't been, I wouldn't have cared because I had used every ounce of energy in my body to produce the record exactly the way I wanted it. Fancy brought Bobby Gentry back to the top of the charts in a big way and boosted my credibility sky high. It was a great era for Bobby and me. Bobby came back several years later to record some more. Well, that song actually reached number 31 on the Billboard Top 40 in 1969. A good-sized hit.
Yeah, not bad.
But not like Ode to Billy Joe.
Yeah, it's not a top 10.
But there you go. Now, while in Los Angeles working on a project, again reading from the book, I met Mike Kerb, the president of MGM Records. We were having dinner with several other music people, and I was amazed at Mike's knowledge of the work that I had done as a record producer in Muscle Shoals. He knew every small detail about Arthur Alexander, Jimmy Hughes, and the Tams records, down to which musician played what instruments, and the dates the records were released. I was even more amazed at how young he looked to be president of a record company. Most record company presidents I met were in their mid-40s to 50s, but Mike looked like a handsome 18-year-old senior in high school or a college fraternity brother. Mike asked me to fly to Las Vegas with him to see a new act that he was extremely excited about. When I asked who the act was, he says, "I'm afraid if I tell you who the act is, you won't go." I was on a roll as a successful producer, and I knew I had to be very selective about committing to doing unknown acts and producing records that were failures, since Capitol would only allow me to do 3 outside acts per hour deal. So I tried to beg off, but Mike was very persistent and finally talked me into joining him. but he would never tell me who was on the Vegas lineup. We flew to Vegas that evening, where we had front row seats in the main ballroom at Caesar's Palace. It turned out that the act Mike wanted me to see was the Osmonds, a five-member group of brothers who opened their part of the show with their version of He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother. They sang the complete song a cappella and in five-part harmony, and they sounded like a five-headed man singing, which absolutely floored me. Though they were regulars on the nationally televised variety series The Andy Williams Show, I had never seen them. I didn't have time for TV back then because I was always buried in the studio producing records and seldom came up for air. After the show, Mike took me backstage and introduced me to the five brothers, one by one. Alan, the oldest, Wayne, the comedian of the group, Jay, who was the drummer, and a great one, Merle, who would become one of the lead singers, and Donnie, who was the youngest but was already breaking the little girls' hearts. I also met their mother and father, Olive and George, the boys' brother Jimmy, who wasn't in the group, and their only sister, Marie. My first impression of the Osmond family was that they were kind, gentle, hardworking people who were totally family-oriented and very clean-cut, very conservative. As I was flying home to Muscle Shoals, my mind started racing like the wind, and I started thinking seriously about what I could do with the Osmonds and how I could translate their youth, good looks, and showmanship into music that would rock the world. They were very devout Mormons from Utah, so I knew their records would have to be quite conservative. Considering their religious convictions, I would have to be especially careful about lyric content. But I felt I needed something positive with a strong dance beat and not just a beautiful love song. Another five-brother act, the Jackson Five, was burning up the charts. They were a black group on Motown, but both white and black kids were wild about them. I felt that white kids were buying the Jackson 5 records not because they were black, but because they were the only group playing the kind of music kids could relate to. So if I could somehow develop the Osmonds into that kind of group, I felt you could capture at least part of that record market. It wasn't that hard to figure out. I had produced just about every kind of music at that time, including blues, jazz, southern rock, pop, and rock and roll, but I hadn't made a record for teenage America. With the right song, I knew that I could capitalize on that huge bubblegum market too. So, taking advice I had been given a few years earlier by my old mentor, Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records, I employed one of my top songwriters in Memphis, Tennessee, George Jackson, to write a teeny bopper Jackson 5-type song that we could record on the Osmonds. Now, if you remember, we talked a little bit about George Jackson on previous shows. That was one of those names that I said, remember his name.
Okay.
This is actually why. George wrote One Bad Apple without ever seeing or meeting the group. And he and one of my other songwriter musicians who ran my studio in Memphis, Mickey Buckins, cut a fantastic demo on it that I really hoped I could copy without losing that great groove. Their demo already sounded like a hit to me. I could hardly wait to get everyone in the studio, but first I had to find out which brother was the strongest lead singer. They sang for me one at a time, and I found we had two great lead vocalists in the group, Donnie and Merle, and I wanted to integrate them both and let each one sing a portion of the song. Merle was older and had the bigger, funkier voice, so he sang all the lead vocals except the little boy's high part that Donnie sang. The other three members of the group sang all the backing harmonies. This, in my opinion, is where Fame Music, as far as an R&B, you know, roots house, its reputation changes drastically. But not its ability to record hits. Here's the Osmonds with One Bad Apple.
Woo!
right. One Bad Apple. Number one all over the world, particularly strong in Japan, but number one for 5 weeks here in the United States.
It was number one with me.
All of the black radio stations thought the group was black. I even got a telegram from Berry Gordy of Motown, the company that launched the Jackson 5, congratulating me and acknowledging my success with an all-new family-oriented group of pop harmony singers. The Osmonds became a pop music phenomenon. They looked great. They were dynamite on stage. They played instruments, and they could write great songs. Like Bobby Gentry, they were the complete package. After One Bad Apple, the Osmonds and I cut several more big hits together, including Double Lovin', Yo-Yo, and Down by the Lazy River.
I loved Yo-Yo.
You remember that song?
Yeah, sure.
One day, while I was recording the Osmonds in Los Angeles, I took Jim Benchy, the program director for the RKO, the national radio chain, took him by the studio in the Valley and introduced him to the Osmonds. He said, Jim said, you know, Rick, you could put Donny Osmond's face on an album cover and it would become a million seller even without any music in it. So in passing, I mentioned this to Mike Kerb, who knew of Bill and Jim and the power of the RKO chain. And Mike thought it was a great idea for me to record Donny as a solo act. Donny was already an idol to millions of little girls, so I started looking for songs for a 12-year-old boy to sing that little girls could fall in love with. I'd always believed in the song Sweet and Innocent that Billy Sherrill and I wrote for Roy Orbison years earlier, and I thought it would be perfect for Donny's little boy image. I updated it to fit Donny, then I cut it with an up-tempo dance beat using flutes, piccolos, and strings to give it a teeny bopper flavor. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but we actually, when we started the series, we were talking about Rick Hall's very earliest days, and we played that track and a bit of the Donny Osmond track as well. So we'd no need for us to go back there.
Oh, okay.
At this point in time.
Darn it. I thought I was going to get to hear that song again.
We know where we are with this thing. Now, the thing is, like, the Osmonds' second hit after One Bad Apple, as I said, was a song called Double Lovin'. What's interesting about that, you know, that's a song also written by the same man, George Jackson, that was also recorded before the Osmonds put it out by a man named Spencer Wiggins. Now, Spencer was signed to the Gold Wax label, which was the label run by Doc Russell and Quinton Claunch, who was actually well associated with Hi Records, or I should say with that studio for a while. This was his other project. And Rick Hall bought Spencer Wiggins out of his contract, taking all of his recordings and his back catalog with him, and had released the song Double Lovin' as the A-side for Spencer Wiggins. This song, though, that I want to play is actually the B-side of that Spencer Wiggins single, a song that was originally recorded at Fame by Etta James back in 1967. This is a 1970 update performed by Spencer Wiggins of the song that you may know, of course, as I'd Rather Go Blind.
Something told me it was over when I saw you and him talking. Something deep down in my soul said, cry, boy, when I saw you and that boy walking now. Go blind, girl, than to see you walk away from me, child. No. So you see, I love you so much, and I don't wanna watch you leave me, baby. Most of all, I just don't wanna be free, no. To my lips now, baby, reveal the tears that was on my face, yeah. you walk away from me now. See you walk away from me today. Please don't leave me, darling. I just don't wanna see you go, darling.
Ooh, that went quick.
Yes, it did.
All right, so that's Spencer Wiggins with the B-side of his version of Good Lovin'. Let's play another track. Now, this is by a band called Brothers Unlimited. This is one of the acts that was signed to Fame. But interestingly, the record did not come out on Fame Records. Capitol, I guess, thought that they had enough potential, so Capitol brought them over and released their album on Capitol. As I said, the band is called Brothers Unlimited. This song is called Take Me Back. Contemporary sound for the time right at the end of the decade there, or the start of a new one, 1970. Brothers Unlimited, the song is called Take Me Back. Now, around this time, Rick Hall was achieving attention internationally. Like you see, he knew this records were selling all over the place, especially now that the Osmonds had hits, like I said, as far away as Japan and in Europe, which brought a Swedish TV company to actually come to interview him at Fame Studios. And while they were there, they were filming him at work while he was recording a specific track. It happens to be this song by Willie Hightower. And the song that they were recording at that time was the song Walk a Mile in My Shoes.
Wow.
The Joe South song. But it was not Joe South who was recording it. Now, Rick Hall, since it was already a hit for Joe South, is basically in his interview saying this about it. I don't think the production on the original record is very good, even though it is a big hit record. So I want to get an R&B version of it. I'm cutting it basically for an R&B record, but I'm hoping that it will go pop and will pick up some sales that he'll miss. In fact, I think I've cut a better record than the Joe South version.
Wow, that's gutsy.
Right. Well, the thing is, I cannot disagree with him that the production of the original Walk a Mile in My Shoes is not very good. But the song is. And the first time you hear the song, I don't think that people are as obsessed about production qualities as producers are.
Yes.
You know?
I agree.
So even if this version by Willie Hightower is technically superior as a production, I think that most of us are going to, you know, stick with remembering the Joe South version. However, just to hear how it was mixed up and switched over to like be something a little bit more in an R&B style, here's Rick Hall's version performed by Willie Hightower. Hightower. That song charted, not high, number 107.
It's a good version.
But it did chart. And this is like, well, it was, you know, while Joe South's song obviously had the edge. Now, this next song, though, Heidi, I'm going to have to dedicate this portion of the show to you.
Uh-oh.
I've been waiting for this one to come for a long time. Again, reading from the book. The biggest hit that Clarence Carter and I ever had together was a complete departure from anything else he ever did. The song was called Patches. And I fell in love with it the first time I ever heard it.
Me too.
Jerry Wexler's assistant, Jerry Greenberg, had just taken over as vice president of Atlantic Records, and the first move that he made was to send me an album by the chairman of the board, an incredible group on Holland and Dozier's label Invictus Records, distributed by Capitol. The album included Patches. So how about that? That's the original version of the song by Chairman of the Board.
How about that?
A song written by General Johnson, the leader of the group. Jerry Greenberg told me, Rick, I think the song Patches is a smash for Clarence Carter. The song was about a poor country boy who has to become a man and take care of his family and their farm after his father passes on. The song reminded me of me and my father, but it was also a story everybody could relate to, and I knew I could produce a number one record on it. I told Jerry, you're right. It is a great song for Clarence if I can get him to cut it. I thought that Patches would be my Tobacco Road, my Tennessee Williams play, my William Faulkner novel. It was grease and funk and poverty and death and destruction. But Clarence didn't like it. Clarence had just come off the road when he arrived at my studio. He wanted to go to a hotel and get a good night's sleep, but I was anxious to get to work on Patches. The musicians were all set up in the studio ready to record. I played Clarence the song, and he looked at me with a startled look on his face and said, "Are you serious? There's no way I can do that song." Clarence was a sophisticated and highly educated man, and he simply couldn't relate to the poor country boy lyrics. He said, "I'm not doing it. I'm not doing anything that's degrading to my race." Now, unlike Clarence, I didn't hear it as a black man's song or a white man's song. So I never thought of it as casting poor blacks in a negative or stereotypical light. I heard it as the story of my daddy. But Clarence is a proud man, and he just didn't want to do it.
Everybody's best song, they never want to do it.
Isn't it so often the case, right?
Unbelievable.
I said, "Clarence, give me an hour with it. If we're not both crazy about it, after an hour, we'll throw it in the garbage." I told him, "This is a number one hit across the board, Clarence. The song will set you apart from other artists and everybody else out there." I never said a word to him about my father or how the song related to me, but Clarence trusted my instincts, and he knew that I was totally overwhelmed by the song. I thought, with a blind black man from Alabama singing it with a voice as big as an oak tree, how could this not be a hit? Now, Clarence always wrote his lyrics in Braille for recording, but we were really under the gun with Patches, and the pressure was on. As he said, he only had 1 hour to cut it. So I had my assistant, Sonny Limbo, stand behind him at the microphone. Sonny said, "Clarence, I'm going to whisper the line you're about to sing while you're singing the line before it." It sounds unbelievable, but it worked. Americans obviously identified with it because the song became our first number one pop and R&B smash and Clarence's musical trademark in the mainstream market. Here's Patches.
I was born and raised down in Alabama on a farm way back up in the woods. I was so ragged that folks used to call me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, cause deep down inside he was hurt cause he'd done all he could. My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education he never had. He did wonders when the times got bad. The little money from the crops he raised barely paid the bills we made. Oh, life had kicked him down to the ground. When he tried to get up, life would kick him back down. One day, papa called me to his dying bed. Put his hands on my shoulders and in tears he said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son, to pull the family through. My son, it's all left up to you. Two days later, Papa passed away, and I became a man that day. So I told Mama I was gonna quit school, but she said that was Daddy's strictest rule. So every morning before I went to school, I fed the chickens and I chopped wood too. Sometimes I felt that I couldn't go on. I wanted to leave, just run away from home. But I would remember what my daddy said, with tears in his eyes on his dying bed. He said, "Patches, I'm depending on you, son. I've tried to do my best. It's up to you. One day a strong rain came and washed all the crops away. And at the age of 13, I thought I was carrying the weight of the whole world on my shoulders. And you know, Mama knew what I was going through, cause every day I had to work the fields, cause that's the only way we got our meals. See, I was the oldest of the family, and everybody else depended on me. Every night I heard my mama pray, Lord, strength to make another day. Though years have passed and all the kids have grown, they just took Mama to a brand new home. Lord knows, people, I shed in tears, but my daddy's voice kept me through the years. Saying, Patches, I'm depending on you, son, to pull the family through. My son, it's all left up to you. Oh, I can still hear Papa's voice say, Patches, I'm depending on you, son. I've tried to do my best. It's up to you.
Biggest hit of Clarence Carter's career. It's a song that he basically almost walked away from.
Kills me every time I hear that.
It's a deeply emotional song. It's really funny. It always, like, you know, brings up, you know, like wells of emotion when you hear it, right?
I'm like crying my eyes out right now.
Well, it was a number four hit in the summer of 1970. The songwriter, as we said, it was the chairman of the board, the leader of the chairman of the board. Do you remember who that is? Because they had a big hit in 1970 as well. In fact, that's how this song became came to the attention of everybody else, because their hit was a number three hit in 1970. And you remember the song, Give Me Just a Little More Time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's Chairman of the Board. So that's...
I thought you were making a reference to Sinatra.
No.
The other chairman of the board.
Right, right. Yeah, that was the band and called themselves Chairman of the Board. Well, I mentioned that George Jackson was the songwriter for the first Osmond Brothers hit, One Bad Apple. And if you recall, when we were reading from the text about what Rick Hall was talking about the songwriter, George Jackson, he said that his demo was pretty much a finished product. Well, the Jacksons' follow-up hit, we mentioned, was called Double Lovin'. Rather than play that, which we could, I think it might be pretty cool because I actually have access to George Jackson's demo of that song. So we can hear the songwriter as he wrote it, as he recorded it for himself. And this is what the song sounded like before it was given to the Osmonds to record. George Jackson singing his own composition called A Double Lovin'.
Gonna double your lovin', double your fun. You get two for the price of one. Double your lovin', double your fun. You get two for the price of one. Took me a long time to find a good woman, one that would be true. That's why I'm gonna double what it takes, baby, to hold on to you. I'm gonna make my loving twice as good as it was before. I'm gonna love you so good.
Reasonable hit for the Osmonds. There it is in its original form, as performed by the songwriter George Jackson, Double Lovin'. Now, one thing that seems to be a recurring theme with Rick Hall, he just had so much like bad luck and betrayal in his career, and or betrayal, that it is almost mind-boggling how much this man had survived with things that had would continually go wrong, with people, you know, doing one thing, or saying one thing, and then eventually doing another, losing his musicians. It just goes on and on and on. Well, time for another story like that.
Oh, boy.
Again, reading from
if
his
book.
If it
wasn't for bad luck, he wouldn't have any at all.
Really? Well, with every triumph in the music business, there seems to be a corresponding tragedy. As good as you may be, as relentless as you are, and as uncompromising as you become, the first thing you need to learn is that nobody in this business really gives a damn or believes in music anymore, except the fans. You have to do it in spite of the world, and then, and even then, you may have only one chance in a million of making it. There will always be tremendous heartbreak, conflicts, lawsuits, lies, betrayals, frustration, disappointment, anger, and humiliation. You have to fight to find a hit song, fight to find the right artist, fight to cut a hit, fight to promote it and sell it yourself, and then you have to fight to get paid. Once you do get a hit record, the hotshot lawyer will come along, sign the talent to a management deal, and then sue you to get out of their contract. So you learn to become mean. You learn to become a good bottom-line businessman, and you learn to become a negotiator of contracts. Never mind that you have struggled to become a good musician, songwriter, engineer, and producer. If you're not tough, if you haven't got what it takes to stand up for yourself, for what's right, you're going to get your nose bloodied. A classic case of the dark side of the music industry involves the sudden end of my role as producer of the Osmonds, the group that I had worked so very hard to groom into the biggest teen pop act in the world. One day I was having a casual conversation with the boys and generally discussing their long-term prospects in the music business. I made the passing remark, "Hey, if you ever leave MGM, I think you could get a great deal with another label." It was an innocent comment that I made during studio small talk, building a better relationship with the boys and not thinking about the consequences. I don't know what happened from there, but one day my secretary called me out of a recording studio and said, "Dick Whitehouse, the head of the legal department at MGM Records, wants you on the phone right now." The minute I picked up the phone, I knew the fat was in the fire. Dick went into a ferocious tirade, accusing me of trying to manipulate the Osmonds against MGM. He said, "If you ever tamper with one of our acts again, we'll sue the hell out of you." Even before the phone call from Dick Whitehouse, animosity had started building between Mike Curb and me. When they owed me money, we would send bill after bill, but I usually had to make a personal trip to L.A. and wait in the lobby like a beggar to see Mike before I ever got a check. It was humiliating. I was still cutting big hits on the Osmonds, but my relationship with their label was beginning to sour. The next thing I know, Mike Curb says, "We want to reduce your royalties from 4% to 2% on all the Osmonds' future records." I remarked, "It's funny that you mentioned that, Mike, because I was just about to ask you for a raise. I just produced 5 big hits on you for 2 acts, the Osmonds as a group and Donnie as a solo artist. I believe I'm due a 2% raise instead of a 2% pay cut." I knew that a lot of us Southern boys in the music business had been screwed over by record companies, and I wasn't about to let it happen to me. So I told Mike Curb, "You know what? I don't want to produce the Osmonds for you anymore. I quit." Thus ending that part of his career.
Was unceremonious.
So, you know, like the way studios work, you know, some leave, others come in. Who shows up at this stage of the game around this time but Little Richard?
Wow.
Somebody who has not had a successful career through the 60s. There's no doubt about it. After his flurry of awesome hits around the era of the birth of rock and roll, the glory days of early rock and roll, he was struggling to stay on track. And coming back in and fame in 1970 seemed to might have been a good idea. Two of the musicians that were now working at Fame, Junior Lowe and Travis Wammack, had written a song that Little Richard thought would be good for him. So he recorded it at Fame and ended up releasing it on an album that year. Mixed opinions about it, especially because everybody thinks of Little Richard as the lunatic from 1956, 1957. So this shows a little bit different side of him. It's his version of a song called Greenwood, Mississippi.
Greenwood, Mississippi.
Imagine that, recording at Fame Studios.
It's an unusual take.
We've got time for just one more now for today's show. I believe next week we're going to be wrapping up our coverage of Fame as we then move into the closing phases of this series. But play one more track now. This is by an artist named Roscoe Robinson. You might not know his name personally. He had a minor hit in the 60s. Actually, I went to number 66 on the pop charts, higher on the R&B charts, a song called That's Enough. But he was also a member at various times singing with the Five Blind Boys of Alabama.
Oh, okay.
He was a member there, although he's not blind, but he was in the band. He was also in the
he's
Fair...
He's the sixth member.
Right. or the man who still had all five senses. He was also in the Fairfield Four, another really popular gospel band, and also in the Highway QCs. So this is a guy who's been in like the three strongest male quartet or five, you know, quintets in the gospel circuit. Well, here he is as a solo artist recording for Fame with the song called What Color Is Love. We'll leave you with this song and hope you can join us again next week, everybody. Have a great weekend. Happy Mother's Day.
Bye-bye.
Colors of a rainbow, 'cause there's so many colors to see. All the colors of the world have never been a mystery to me. Still I'm blind to this one thing you see. I know the color of the moon.